once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. It's aspirational that boys and girls would be listening. Welcome to the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure, and on the line with me, I have...
Jeff McClure.
Together, yes, we are bald.
Yes, and I said that very dramatically. Jeff McClure.
Yes, they are radio voices.
It's good.
Yes, as if there are other voices to have when you're on the radio than a radio voice.
Oh, there's this voice.
That's also a radio voice now. You just
it's a radio voice?
Yes.
Okay. Right.
So this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we do vocal tricks on command, I suppose, but we also, we also at least purport to know something about finance and the economy and how to invest and stuff like that. But before we get started on that, we have some disclosures. No, put your clothes back. Not that kind of disclosure.
Oh, come on.
All right.
Well, we probably ought to tell him.
He's going to tell.
Yes.
All right. So the Personal Wealth Coach, which is not just the name of this radio program, it is the name of an SEC registered investment advisory firm. What does that mean? Well, number one, the firm has got some principals in it that are sitting behind the microphones right now. It's a different setup. It's not like we're giving investment advice on the air. So what is that? How does that even work? What's going on here? I'm trying to reword our disclosures to keep them interesting, as if they were ever interesting. But just because the firm's registered with the SEC, that doesn't imply in any way that the SEC likes us. The SEC's job is not to like people or entities. There.
And it doesn't imply that when we do educational programs such as this one, that we're giving investment advice, because investment advice is personal, private, and tailored to your individual needs. And since you can't hear it individually and remain private on the radio or internet,
that's the thing. They
ain't doing that.
They can hear it individually. We just can't tell them individually.
Oh.
So okay. That's like there's a physics warp here in that we can tell it in a broadcast and you can hear it individually. So just very strange.
I can give some investment advice. Buy low, sell high, don't get involved in a land war on the Asian continent.
Very nice. Very nice.
Well, all right,
buy a stock and when it goes up, sell it. If it doesn't go up, don't buy it in the first place.
Right. Well, I'm not sure that that's legal. People did that for a while.
Yeah. All right. So next one up on the list. So we've talked about this is educational. We're hoping to give you the tools to make decisions rather than tell you what decision to make on this program. We're getting our I'm not going to take that one from you. I'm not going to reword it. You love that one too much. You go for it.
Yes, I do. The information that we give on this informational educational radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
So what we've just said by saying that and said information is that we're not warranting or guaranteeing anything that we're saying ever.
Well, that's not entirely true, but that's okay.
But we deem it to be good.
Yeah.
But we don't guarantee it.
We get it from sources that we believe are reliable. Wall Street Journal, United States government departments, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it might not be complete. Matter of fact, one of the things about the information, for example, the Labor Department released a bunch of information this week, and we're going to talk about that.
We're getting ahead of ourselves. Go ahead.
No, wait a minute. That information is not complete. The Labor Department will tell you this is when they come out and say, here's the unemployment rate, and here's the number of people that knew the number of jobs that we created and all that good stuff.
GDP comes out, it's an estimate.
Right. And this is the first estimate, and it'll be changed at least three more times. So we'll virtually guarantee it's wrong.
But it
makes the headlines.
But we won't warranty or guarantee that it's right.
Right. Right.
Right.
That we won't.
Wrong. It's right that, that we won't. Right.
Right.
Oh, wrong.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Now right. You understand economics.
And you have gotten a small amount of torture that our wives experience when we sit near each other at the dinner table.
Right.
Right. Exactly.
So what have we not disclosed?
Let's see. We've talked. Oh, yes. We don't pay for
the radio program.
We don't pay for this program. That is right. True. But we're also not paid for it. We have been gloriously unpaid for this program, in my case, since 1998, and your case, since 1997.
Actually, they found a tape from 1996, so we go back to 1996.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, so every year they have agreed to double our pay, but starting at zero, I'm waiting for compound interest to catch up, and it's just not working.
Do you realize since I was on the air in 1996, this is 25 years.
Wow.
Been doing this insanity for 25 years, and people say, "Why do you do it?" And I say,
"How do you stop? Is there a way? I mean, they don't let us stop."
Well, one thing about having been on the radio for 25 years and now on the internet for however many years we've been on the internet, if you go to our website, which is tpwc.com, and you go to past radio programs or newsletters or whatever, you can see a lot of years what we said was happening and what we said was likely to happen in the near future. And you can check us out to see if we were right or wrong.
Oh, wait. Are we supposed to tell people to do that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think
people should go back and check.
Yeah.
I think it's...
I have, and it scares me.
Yeah. So we're not... What we almost never do is make predictions that aren't reasonable, but sometimes when we make them, people think that sounds unreasonable. So go back and check.
One last thing, if you would like to join with us on the radio program, or you'd like to have us talk about something or have a question or something, you're certainly welcome to give us an email either at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Actually, it'd be better if you did both of them.
Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie. Or the personal wealth coach. Yes.com. Got to throw that out. So, what happened in the market this week? You're already making references in the middle of disclosure. So, you must be raring to go and excited.
Well, you know, if you followed the headlines every day, you would conclude that the stock market crashed horribly during the week.
Oh,
it was a terrible week.
I did follow. I mean, I saw multiple days where they said this is the biggest downward move since another day, not some far distance in the past.
Yeah. And all that kind of stuff. So you'd think that the S&P 500 stock index, which is otherwise affectionately known as SPX, which we use to represent the stock market, would have taken a huge hit this week and the world was coming to an end or something to that effect. There was an element in the market that took a huge hit this week, and we'll get to that. So what actually happened is the S&P 500 declined 1.22% for the week, which is noise. It's within its normal fluctuations when nothing is happening. So the collective wisdom of the literally millions of investors who participate in the S&P 500 stock index for the week was that nothing much of any significance happened.
The collective wisdom between two sides of clearly panicked and greedy. I'm going to sell and I'm going to buy folks are so evenly aligned that they caused a lot of bumps that averaged out to very little of anything.
So basically, we've been running along terrified of COVID, Omicron. And
that sounds like a new Transformers movie, just as a side note.
And terrified that according to the headlines, people are terrified that the Federal Reserve is going to not only cut off stimulus to the economy too fast, but going to raise interest rates suddenly and blow the economy out of the water and put us into a depression or something. And yet the market didn't do much of anything. Now, it's been down for 2 weeks, which I know coming out of this or in this amazingly huge bull market that we've been in for the last year or two. Year and a half, actually. Coming down in 2 weeks, 3.42% sounds horrific to some people, but that's just normal noise movement around. It's only up 0.07% for the trailing 3 months, which has caused people to be very nervous, I think. I don't know why, but...
Wait a minute. Did you say 0.37%?
0.07%.
0.07%. Oh, even smaller. Whoa.
So basically flat for the last, if 3 months ago you had looked at the S&P 500 and you were invested in the S&P 500, let's say you were in an index fund with very little expenses, it pretty much matched the S&P 500 and nothing else, which we don't recommend. And you looked at it 3 months ago and you said, here's my value. And you looked at it again after the market closed on Friday, you'd say, here's my value. And there really hasn't been any change. And you say, so nothing happened in the last 3 months in the market, which is a not unreasonable thing to say. But if you went back and looked at the headlines, you would consider the disaster and catastrophe. I've been upon our heels.
Or conversely, the other end of that, the headlines on the day, the optimists come back and they believe that the future is bright. And so you've got these headlines one day of glowing futures and these headlines the next day of imminent doom. And it all averaged out to, pretty much the same old. Yeah.
Now, since the beginning of the year, and we're approaching the end of the year, obviously, the S&P 500 is up about 21%, nearly 21%. So is the Mid-Cap Value Index, which we follow, CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index. So it's a great year. We've had wonderful returns so far. And there's really not much to be concerned about. And we'll get into the economics of that. Now, several things did change this week.
Oh, yeah.
10-year U.S. Treasury note yield slipped lower. It declined about 8% for the week to 1.357. It was a 1.6 at the end of September. It was a 1.6%. Now it's 1.357%, which means it's been sliding down during that period of time. And the headlines during that period of time are full of fear that the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates.
Right.
So in reaction to the fact that interest rates are going to go up, the interest rates came down, which tells you how rational the markets appear to be on the surface. Actually, there's a reason for that, but we can go into that. Oil. West Texas Intermediate Crude Oil, which is the one we follow because it's the U.S. benchmark. Now, the Brent, North Sea Brent is the global benchmark, but we use WTI.
Yeah, we think
Texas Intermediate.
We think it tastes better on our spaghetti. So that's the real reason why we choose it.
It's a little more sweet than some oils.
I would hate to have that job, just as a side note. The one that is
tasting it.
Is this sweet crude? Yep. That's pretty. Yep. Get Joe. He's good at this.
Okay.
Go ahead. So West Texas Intermediate.
So it's down to 66.26. Remember, it was up around $80 for a while. So it's down. It's down 18% in the last month. And there's a good reason for that, though. First, the U.S. and China and Korea and Japan and some other folks decided to release oil from their strategic reserves. Now, they haven't actually done it yet. They just decided to do it.
Yes. Agreements are very important.
And there was the headlines that came out said there's not enough oil going to be released from the reserves to make any difference. So don't pay any attention to this. But apparently OPEC Plus, and OPEC Plus includes Russia and some other countries that are not part of OPEC, that have all got together to create a monopoly in oil and manipulate the oil prices, decided it was a threat. So they decided to raise their monthly pumping rate by 400,000 barrels, which I think is kind of funny. Reason I say that, Russia is pretty much at their peak pumping rate now.
They can't really, they don't have enough pipes to get it out. They can't get it in there any faster at this point. They're at pressure capacities.
And other countries are pretty much at their maximum production rate right now, which means basically Saudi Arabia and maybe a couple of other countries in that region will increase their rates a lot and make a lot of money, which is the way this works, which is okay. So expect, hopefully, prayerfully, gasoline prices to slip lower before too long. Okay, now, and the other thing, well, the interest rates are down. Oil prices are down. The stock market is level, and the one other thing, we don't normally talk about Bitcoin. Bitcoin dropped 20%, mostly last night.
That's funny, because last night we sent out a newsletter And in the newsletter, we made the reference to the fact that there are a series of reports out on a type of decentralized finance that is allowing people to take loans against their cryptocurrencies to buy or sell more cryptocurrencies. And that in the stock and bond world was called margin. So you go get a loan, and there's regulations on how much you can borrow in the stock and bond world because that's a regulated area. Where cryptocurrency, that doesn't exist. Those regulations aren't there. So there's not really a limit beyond how much you can get approved for on how much you can use it for collateral.
There's also a study that came out. Admittedly, the study was conducted in 2019. But I think it's relevant. About 7 out of 10 crypto trades across the board in the various cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin and Dogecoin and so on, that was going on at the time.
Dogecoin.
Dogecoin. Well, this is D-O-G at the front of it, so I'm just calling it Dogecoin. It has a picture of a dog on popular emblem for it. Actually, there are no real coins there, so those pictures of coins you see aren't real, which we could go into. 7 out of 10 trades in this study were determined to be people buying Bitcoin from themselves. Now, why does that mean? Why would they buy Bitcoin from themselves? Because if they buy at a slightly higher price each time, they don't make or lose any money because it's just a transaction and they're paying themselves to buy Bitcoin from themselves. By raising the prices as they buy Bitcoin from themselves, they manipulate the price upward. And so people see the price going upward, and people who previously didn't own the Bitcoins started buying new Bitcoins. Now, that's totally illegal in the securities markets. The SEC would come down on them with both feet. But since the crypto markets are pretty much unregulated, it's kind of standard procedure. People are doing what's called market churning. And there's apparently, at least at that point, 70% of the transactions were market churning, which is people buying a stock, not because they're really buying the stock, but appearing to buy the stock.
In this case,
if it were stock.
Yeah, in this case
it's a cryptocurrency. Bitcoin.
Yeah.
To drive the price up. And if that's true, history says that the thing is way the heck overpriced. Now, can I throw something else in there about this?
Please do. Go ahead.
It's really hard to tell whether cryptocurrency is overpriced or underpriced because it doesn't represent anything. It has no intrinsic value. So if something that by itself has no value whatsoever has a price, is it too high or too low? And if you're Warren Buffett and Jeff McClure, you say it was too high at a dollar. A dollar per coin was too high. So we'll see how this works out. I really have a feeling, and my feeling may be wrong because I'm old, and I'm old-fashioned in many ways, that this cryptocurrency will not end crypto trading and crypto values and so on, as they are being done today. Crypto coins will not end pleasantly, but it will end. And when it ends, it will be an extremely unpleasant event.
Your segue here, if this is the end of the market commentary, it kind of leads to both questions that we have waiting in email and something that you and I have both talked about over the past several weeks about needing to discuss. This is very interesting. How can we tie cryptocurrency in with a 60-40 or 50-50 bond stock portfolio, or what's happening in Turkey to the lira?
I got an email
saying our modulation is
yeah,
low.
Yep.
Yeah.
So we need to crank it up a little bit.
Dane, I don't know if you can hear us at the moment, but we're getting folks saying that over the air we're coming out pretty quiet. Okay, so how am I going to tie all this together? Number one, we wanted to talk about modern monetary theory a little bit because we get questions on that all the time. What is it? On one side of the political conversation, it is like the glowing end-all that will solve all problems for everyone. And on the other end of the political spectrum, there is absolutely nothing good about it, and it will cause the destruction of the universe or something near that extreme.
As we know it.
Right. And with almost all things economic, the reality is neither of those extremes. And what does that have to do with Bitcoin? And what does that have to do with what's happening in Turkey right now? What is happening in Turkey right now? So I've just kind of preluded with modern monetary theory, and that's just this basic theory that governments can keep borrowing money to make up differences in budget. So we'll address that in just a second, because that was a very simplified explanation of what it is. What's happening in Turkey right now is that they're experiencing 20%+ inflation year over year. And the lira is, you know, the headlines say it's out of control, run away. And they're talking about people in bread lines and not eating meat except for once a week. And so they're in some economic turmoil over there. And a lot of the inflation has happened relatively quickly. A lot of this happened in big bursts of overnight type jumps in inflation, very much like what we saw in cryptocurrency prices just last night, dropping 20% almost across the board. Almost no cryptocurrencies were safe from it. Well, what happened? What was that? What is it? What does all this stuff, all these three subjects, have to do with each other? Well, confidence. Our money, or any value of anything, is just based on what we all believe. And I know that's weird. It sounds suddenly like we've gotten into a spiritual aspect or something, but it's reality. If there's five people in an auction that want to buy the same grand piano, that value's going to go up. And if nobody wants to buy the grand piano at the auction, then the value's essentially negative, because you have to move it out of the place. And we see that in the market. I mean, last year at the worst of the panic over the pandemic, we had negative price per barrel for oil. You had to pay people to take the oil off your hands because we ran out of space to store it. It's hard to remember that just, you know, a year and a half later, but it wasn't that long ago. The market and its confidence on what we want. You just mentioned this on talking about the news about the strategic oil reserves of all these major countries have agreed to release oil into the market. They haven't done it yet, but the price dropped. Well, wait a minute. If it's truly supply and demand, the supply hasn't changed yet. We just agreed that it would. So what happened there? Confidence, belief. When people are afraid, they're willing to pay more for things or take less for things when they're selling. When people are greedy, they're willing to pay more than they normally would. So this affects currency as well. It also affects how the debt of a nation is treated. So all of this is coming together. In Turkey, they have lowered interest rates multiple times during this period of rising inflation. Well, what does that mean? This sounds like econ babble. If you raise interest rates in the bank, at the bank, and if you could put a money in a CD that would pay you 8% right now, well, a lot of you would consider taking money out of the stock market, which is kind of bumpy and flat and scary, and putting it at a CD. So what does that do? It moves money out of circulation. It takes money out of the economy and puts it into places where it's not easy to spend, like a CD. If you lower interest rates, then the banks aren't paying you very much, and it's easy to borrow money. So why would you leave money sitting in the bank? Why don't you just spend it? So that leads to more spending going on. And at any given time, there's enough money sitting in the bank accounts to cause thousands and thousands of percentages of inflation if everybody liquidated all their bank accounts at the same time and tried to spend it all at once. Does it really change the value of the currency? No, it changes the belief in the currency. So what's happening with the lira right now is they've lowered
the Turkish lira.
The Turkish lira, yeah.
Not the Italian lira.
Correct. Well, there's not an Italian lira anymore.
Well.
It's a euro now.
Right, you got it.
But you can say it with an Italian accent if you wish.
Lira.
The euro. That was a really Mario-esque Italian accent.
Okay.
Boys and girls. Okay. So they've lowered interest rates in a high inflation period, which is the opposite of what everyone agrees on as the right way to do it right now. That if you...
Well, not everyone.
No, obviously the head of state in Turkey, Erdogan, is firmly disagreeing with that and saying that one must lower interest rates because more money in the system would cause more investment in the system and you can hire more people with that. What he's missing is that wages rise with inflation. So you don't actually wind up hiring more people when you get inflation. You wind up paying the same people more money and charging more money for the things that you're selling. So his belief is not the belief of everyone. Lowering the interest rates when they did not cause 20% inflation. I know this is kind of a weird thing. I just said you shouldn't lower interest rates in an inflationary environment, and now they're getting runaway inflation, and they lowered interest rates. It wasn't the act of lowering the interest rates. That affects such a small amount of the money. It's a very small amount of the overall. If you lower interest rates by less than a percentage point, it shouldn't cause the value of all the money to go up 20%. So what happened was that in acting against the confidence of everyone's experience and the most grounded wisdom on money, it shook the confidence of the Turkish people in their own economy and in their own currency. So they've been rushing to sell it for dollars as soon as they get paid, which causes the price of the lira to fall, just like trying to sell the piano when there's less people that want to buy it. So the value falling means it takes more of them to buy the same stuff. That's inflation. And when you lower interest rates at the same time, more money is available to be loaned out to make those same purchases. So we have a grand experiment going right now on debt and on inflation. And what's funny is that the same experiment may not be applicable in 100 years when we have a different understanding of what might cause inflation, because it comes back to our belief. And the Italian people, you got me saying Italians now, the Turkish people no longer have confidence in their currency. And so they're lining up early to go and buy gasoline because they're concerned that the price by the end of the day is going to be higher than it is at the beginning of the day. And by everybody buying it early, it causes the price to go up faster. So confidence, this is what happens when there's a run on the bank. When everybody goes to get their money, of course not all the money is sitting in the bank ready to come out as paper. That's not reasonable anymore. But if everybody shows up and asks for paper, they're not going to get it, which could cause people to be terrified and everybody to say the bank's no good anymore.
Well, modern monetary theory has as a basis something that doesn't apply in Turkey,
right?
Which is that if your economy is big enough and stable enough, like the U.S. economy is, where you're not dependent upon the value of other currencies in your economy, then you can, within limits, and I've read several papers on this now, within limits, you can actually borrow a lot more than you thought you could borrow before and not create undue inflation. And a big player in this is the central bank. Now, if the Federal Reserve, for example, if we started, that's what their job is right now. If it looked like we're going to get deflation, they start buying bonds on the open market. That puts more money in the system. If it looks like we're going to get inflation, they stop buying bonds and sometimes raise interest rates to pull money out of the system. I would go with Milton Friedman here.
Yeah.
Inflation everywhere and always is a function of the quantity of money in circulation, the velocity of the money that's in circulation, and the availability of goods and services. So, for example, and I think this is what we're seeing now.
Yeah.
If there's a shortage of goods and services, if there's, because of the supply chain issues primarily and labor issues, prices go up. It's supply and demand. It's that simple. So the same amount of money in the economy would cause prices to go up. Now, can I, one more thing here that I think is important before we move on. politically, we tend to see this as something the government did, but that's not true. For example, in the United States, yes, we had two big stimulus bills where a lot of money was given away to people President Trump and the Republicans. We had one big stimulus bill under the Democrats. So if you're a Republican, you're saying the Democrats' bill did it. And if you're a Democrat, you're saying the Republicans' bill did it. Neither is true. And here's why I say that. The Eurozone is currently experiencing the highest inflation they've ever had year over year. And none, as far as I can tell, none of the money that we or maybe a tiny amount leaked over, the money that was given by Congress and the two presidents to the people of the United States was actually sent to the Eurozone. So it's going on, and it's going on in developing countries. It's going on all over the places. A couple of places it's not going on, and this is really significant. They're not having inflation in Japan. Now, note that Japan now has a government debt that's 250% of its gross domestic product, which is mind-bogglingly huge, more than ours is. And they don't have it. They're having trouble with deflation. So the simplistic answers that you may hear on the radio or see people talking about on TV probably are not true. And it's a little more complex than that.
And that's where the wrap-up of this is. Confidence when it comes to pricing is a big part of this, in that if we all agree that something is worth something, that by definition is its value. So when the stock market says this is the price, that is the price we've all agreed on for that moment. When we talk about modern monetary theory, the reality isn't the imminent doom of the right wing, nor is it the panacea of the left wing. It's a reality in that the United States has only had a balanced budget for 1 year out of the last about 80. That means that we've been in debt, in growing debt, during that entire period. And we have not experienced runaway inflation. If this were based on a commodity like gold, we wouldn't have enough of it. We would actually have deflationary tendencies there. Big ones, because there's not enough gold to back the amount of value that the dollar holds right now. So we would see where the dollar could buy a lot more things and people would be paid a lot less for doing the same amount of work if it were linked to something finite. Modern monetary theory says that if you've got enough confidence behind you, you can borrow as much as you want forever. What it's missing in the extreme is that confidence fades if you continue to do things that everyone agrees aren't reasonable. That's what everyone's agreeing about with a quick price move downward in cryptocurrency, with the huge upward jumps in inflation and in one-day periods in Turkey. It's all related to confidence and what we believe at any given moment. If enough people suddenly change their mind on something or are scared enough to change their mind about something, it could be a permanent change. And that's, you know, with the dollar, that's part of the reason why the Federal Reserve, when they speak, they're so freaking boring to listen to.
Yes, I love it.
Because that's part of the confidence aspect of these people are really, really smart when they work really hard to sound that way to give you confidence in our own system. It's part of the system to give you confidence in it.
Alan Greenspan famously said, "Since I have been chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, I have learned how to make speeches in incoherent mutterings and mumblings."
Because their job is to set the world at ease. And it works, because you need someone in a catastrophe all the time saying, "It'll be all right, we can get through this." That's their job. So they're never going to have a panicked meeting. Don't expect that from the Federal Reserve ever. And people say they're not taking this seriously enough or whatever. Well, that's their job. They may be taking it very seriously. And you see that in the minutes that they post. And that's why when the minutes get posted, they're like, "Oh, this doesn't sound like what they were talking about, that everything's fine. What they're talking about, these things that might not be fine in the minutes." They're telling you everything's fine because they think on average it is. But even if it isn't, it actually helps to say it is. How's that for weird?
Yeah, but they got to Their credibility is important. So right. if it isn't, they need to say something that indicates
acknowledge the danger at the very least. And they're doing a good job of that. So that was the wrap up of a long semi soliloquy, and I will give the floor majorly back to you for the rest of the hour. But I wanted to kind of tie up, well, not the whole hour, but I'll let you.
Well, there's only a little bit of hour left.
We will be back on the other side of these commercials. If you'd like to join the program and ask us some questions, our email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. That is Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie or thepersonalwealthcoach.com. And we'll be back on the other side of these very important announcements from our sponsors. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff
McClure. I need to wait for your mouth to move. We can't do this thing where we used to speak so melodically together. There's lag between us with video conferencing and such.
We need to practice or something.
Yes. We sit and chant our own names to each other.
Yeah, but not with lag. Time.
We have to practice with lag now. So, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, and you can reach us via email at either Jeff, well, either and or. In other words, Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. And if you send one to each of us, it'd be kind of nice.
Yeah. Or just copy one of this or the other of us or
whatever.
You could forward it after the fact, but now we're getting really complicated.
Forward after?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Go to your scent box and forward. Yeah, just for the
fun. Well, my dog has a scent box.
That's his nose.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gotcha. So what is the next thing on your list of things to talk about?
Well, we had a couple of questions.
We did.
About guardrails and turkeys. I can answer the turkey question very easily. The question from John, what will be the impact to the global economy if Turkey crashes and burns? Not much. Turkey is already pretty well crashed and burned in many ways. The impact, if Turkey, depends on how Turkey crashes and burns. There's a lot of, remember, Turkey is right next to Syria. And there's a lot of people in Turkey who would like to create a failed nation state and jihad and do unpleasant things. If Turkey were to crash and burn, I don't know, it probably wouldn't have a big effect on the world economy. Turkey is not a big economic player in the world. It's a little tiny economic player in the world.
It is a top 20 nation. So, but as a percentage of the other top 20, I think it's number 16 or was at its peak. It has been in decline for the past half a decade.
Well, actually about 600 years.
Well, I mean, it was coming back recently, coming back up the world scale. I mean, from early 2000 on, there was a Wall Street Journal article on this. The wealth of your average citizen in Turkey has increased 20-fold. There's plumbing in the slums of Istanbul. So, I mean, this is a big deal. Now, having said that, the external investment has been a big part of how that was occurring because they were becoming much more open to what we would consider free market industrialized society. And they've been pulling back from that since Erdogan took the head position and really seriously since the military attempted a coup several years back. He's really locked up Turkey, and a lot of the foreign investment has been falling off. So you're seeing the economy kind of droop.
Well, the question you ask yourself is, what have you bought recently, or what do you need in your household that is only manufactured in Turkey? And you will be followed by a long silence. Rugs, maybe. But you bought probably all the rugs you need to buy for a while.
Turkish delight. No, I make
that. Yeah, we don't use that anymore. Basically, if Turkey were to vanish from the world economy, the economy might have the tiniest little bump in the world, and that would be it.
Let me kind of qualify that, because if you go back a few years and listen to us talk about the Greek possible exit from the Eurozone and the panic that was in our voice during all of that, because it wouldn't just be Greece going down. They have all of these crazy financial ties to other big players in the Eurozone where the Turks don't. They aren't part of the Eurozone. They're using their own currency, and therefore they're not like the first major domino that's going to cause a collapse of an expanding number of larger countries.
Damage to the world economy is pretty much ameliorated. The Turkish lira has devalued at such a high rate of speed that people who are even invested in Turkey wouldn't lose a lot of money, because they basically lost it already.
Right.
So, as I said, the danger in Turkey collapsing would be that it could become a failed nation state at that point.
And if it did so,
then that would be a problem.
Yeah, I think another way to look at this is all of the economies in the world basically collapsed for a very short period of time during COVID. I mean, they're close to the beginning. And most of them have been in the process of recovery, where Turkey really hasn't. That's kind of the simplest way to do it. It's not like they're suddenly collapsing. It's more like they're not. They like everybody else, they fell down and they're just not getting up very well. One of the other stories that came out had to do with, we're skipping now from Turkey, by the way. Well, that was a rather abrupt segue from Turkey.
We got the question about guardrails too.
Yeah. Why don't you take that then?
One of the issues we had John ask about guardrails, on a portfolio and some sophisticated way of doing it. And it actually ties in together with something else I wanted to talk about in the limited time we have left. And that is the 60-40 portfolio and 4% withdrawal rate, which used to be kind of the rule of thumb in retirement. If you had 60% in stocks, 40% in bonds, and you could then withdraw beginning at 4% and adjusted for inflation, and your chances of failure over a 30-year period were minuscule. And that's broke. That's gone. Several studies have suggested that, and there's some really good reasons for that. But, and then the question that comes up that goes with that is, how do you protect yourself against that fact? And it was a Wall Street Journal article that suggested you put up guardrails. Actually, what we recommend you do is have reserves and be able to take money from your reserves in some fashion during periods of down market. Why do we say that rather than a 60-40 bond portfolio? Simply put, the 40% of your portfolio that is in bonds is likely to have a near zero return over the next decade and possibly the next 30 years. Why? Look at interest rates as they stand today. For example, if you bought a 30-year treasury bond, if you bought a 20-year treasury bond, you bought a 10-year treasury bond, the 10-year treasury note, which is at 1.357%, the 30-year treasury is less than 2%. There's a general consensus, and the Federal Reserve is certainly working at keeping inflation at better than 2%, 2% or better for the foreseeable future. And it's certainly run higher than that right now. So that if you bought 40% bonds in your portfolio today, you'd have a negative return on 40% of your portfolio. You would actually perform less well than inflation, which meant you'd be losing money in that part of the portfolio. The 60% stocks, well, stocks are at a high point. So over the next decade, they probably will average a little less than they have for the previous decade. So you would have, after inflation, a pretty poor return in your portfolio. 3.3% was the study that came out. But what we recommend you do is, during periods we're not in a major bear market or correction, exercise a consistent, systematic withdrawal from your broadly diversified portfolio that has stocks and bonds and cash and lots of asset classes in it, preferably well-balanced asset classes. And then when the market tips over and goes into a nosedive, stop taking money out of equities. Don't time the market. Don't try to get out of the market and then get back in at the appropriate time. History has proven again and again and again. Well, proven, at least shown again and again and again. That just doesn't work. It's a good way to lose a lot of money. Rather, have enough reserve. And goodness gracious, we've said this for years and years and years. Have enough reserve somewhere in a liquid, low volatility position to carry you for at least 18 months in retirement. Why does that mean? Why? Because bear markets last on average about 18 months historically. And that's why we say at least 18 months. And then have a conservative aspect to your portfolio somewhere, your investment portfolio, that is likely to come back quickly in the event of a bear market or a major correction. If you do that, historically, we can backtest that and say that will carry you through the bad times. And then during good times, what you do is you take more money. When the equity market recovers, you take more money out of equities and replenish your reserves. And that's how you do that. I don't know if you want to call that guardrail. It's active. It doesn't mean you can just sit back and make a portfolio and passively take money out of it every month and survive. You have to be paying attention. You have to know when we're in a correction as opposed to a temporary dip. You have to know when we're in a bear market as opposed to a temporary down in the market, which is what, of course, we do at the Personal Wealth Coaches. You have some criteria for that. And that's the combination of guardrail and why the 60-40 portfolio at 4% probably won't work into the future. Actually, the 50-50 portfolio was a study, 50% bonds, 50% equities. And that's a long answer to a short question. So are you still there?
I'm still here. Yeah. And okay. That was a great answer, by the way, just kind of laying it out. There's all these rules of thumb, and what we, I think, collectively have discovered over the years is that a rule of thumb doesn't work for everybody. There's no one size fits all. You really have to look at this with an eye toward all aspects of what's going on. If you say, you know, people say a 4% is a safe withdrawal rate. Well, in what circumstance? It's certainly not from a bank account. We have to keep that in mind. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, we actually have voicemail during the weekend and real live people, I know, gasp, that answer the phone during the weeks. Locally at
254-947-1111.
Or you can reach that line toll free if you have a landline, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our website, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can read our newsletter, sign up for it there, contact us through the contact form. You can listen to radio programs going back lots of years. You can also find those at any of your podcast providers. And you can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.